Chapter 19. Adventures in the Underworld. Journeys to the Stars. The hypothetical third-party theory explains the similarities and the fundamental differences between ancient Egypt and ancient Mesopotamia by proposing that both received a common legacy of civilization from the same remote ancestor. No serious suggestions have been made as to where that ancestral civilization might have been located, its nature, or when it flourished. Like a black hole in space, it cannot be seen. Yet its presence can be deduced from its effects on things that can be seen, in this case the civilizations of Sumer and Egypt. Is it possible that the same mysterious ancestor, the same invisible source of influence, could also have left its mark in Mexico? If so, we would expect to find certain cultural similarities between Mexico's ancient civilizations and those of Sumer and Egypt. We would also expect to be confronted by immense differences resulting from the long period of divergent evolution which separated all these areas in historical times. We would, however, expect the differences to be less between Sumer and Egypt, which were in regular contact with each other during the historical period, than between the two Middle Eastern cultures and the cultures of far-off Central America, which enjoyed at most only haphazard, slight, and intermittent contacts prior to the discovery of the New World by Columbus in AD 1492. Eaters of the dead, earth monsters, star kings, dwarves, and other relatives. For some curious reason that has not been explained, the ancient Egyptians had a special liking and reverence for dwarves. So too did the civilized peoples of ancient Central America, right back to Olmec times. In both cases, it was believed that dwarves were directly connected to the gods, and in both cases, dwarves were favored as dancers and were shown as such in works of art. In Egypt's early dynastic period, more than 4,500 years ago, an ennead of 9 omnipotent deities was particularly adored by the priesthood at Heliopolis. Likewise, in Central America, both the Aztecs and the Mayas believed in an all-powerful system of 9 deities. The Popol Vuh, the sacred book of the ancient Quiche Maya of Mexico and Guatemala, contains several passages which clearly indicate a belief in stellar rebirth, the reincarnation of the dead as stars. After they had been killed, for example, the hero twins, named as Hunapu and Ishbalanque, rose up in the midst of the light, and instantly they were lifted into the sky. Then the arch of heaven and the face of the earth were lighted, and they dwelt in heaven. At the same time ascended the twins' 400 companions who had also been killed, and so they again became the companions of Hunapu and Zubalanque, and they were changed into stars in the sky. The majority of the traditions of the god-king Quetzalcoatl, as we have seen, focus on his deeds and teachings as a civilizer. His followers in ancient Mexico, however, also believed that his human manifestation had experienced death, and that afterwards he was reborn as a star. It is therefore curious, at the very least, to discover that in Egypt, in the Pyramid Age, more than 4,000 years ago, the state religion revolved around the belief that the deceased pharaoh was reborn as a star. Ritual incantations were chanted, the purpose of which was to facilitate the dead monarch's rapid rebirth in the heavens. O king, you are this great star, the companion of Orion, who traverses the sky with Orion. You ascend from the east of the sky, being renewed in your due season and rejuvenated in your due time. We have encountered the Orion constellation before, on the plains of Nazca, and we shall encounter it again. Meanwhile, let us consider the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. Parts of its contents are as old as the civilization of Egypt itself, and it serves as a sort of Baedeker for the transmigration of the soul. It instructs the deceased on how to overcome the dangers of the afterlife, enables him to assume the form of several mythical creatures, and equips him with the passwords necessary for admission to the various stages or levels of the underworld. Is it a coincidence that the peoples of ancient Central America preserved a parallel vision of the perils of the afterlife? There it was widely believed that the underworld consisted of 9 strata, through which the deceased would journey for 4 years, overcoming obstacles and dangers on the way. The strata had self-explanatory names like Place Where the Mountains Crash Together, Place Where the Arrows Are Fired, Mountain of Knives, and so on. In both ancient Central America and ancient Egypt, it was believed that the deceased's voyage through the underworld was made in a boat, accompanied by paddler gods, who ferried him from stage to stage. The tomb of Doublecomb, an 8th-century ruler of the Mayan city of Tikal, was found to contain a representation of this scene. Similar images appear throughout the Valley of the Kings in Upper Egypt, notably in the tomb of Thutmosis III, an 18th dynasty pharaoh. Is it a coincidence that the passengers in the bark of the dead pharaoh, and in the canoe in which Doublecomb makes his final journey, include, in both cases, a dog or dog-headed deity, a bird or bird-headed deity, and an ape or ape-headed deity? The 7th stratum of the ancient Mexican underworld was called the place where beasts devour hearts. Is it a coincidence that one of the stages of the ancient Egyptian underworld, the Hall of Judgment, involved an almost identical series of symbols? At this crucial juncture, the deceased's heart was weighed against a feather. If the heart was heavy with sin, it would tip the balance. The god Thoth would note the judgment on his palate, and the heart would immediately be devoured by a fearsome beast, part crocodile, part hippopotamus, part lion, that was called the Eater of the Dead. Finally, let us turn again to Egypt of the Pyramid Age and the privileged status of the pharaoh, which enabled him to circumvent the trials of the underworld and to be reborn as a star. Ritual incantations were part of the process. Equally important was a mysterious ceremony known as the opening of the mouth, always conducted after the death of the pharaoh and believed by archaeologists to date back to pre-dynastic times. The high priest and 4 assistants participated, wielding the peshenkef, a ceremonial cutting instrument. This was used to open the mouth of the deceased god-king, an action thought necessary to ensure his resurrection in the heavens. Surviving reliefs and vignettes showing this ceremony leave no doubt that the mummified corpse was struck a hard physical blow with the peshenkef. In addition, evidence has recently emerged, which indicates that one of the chambers within the Great Pyramid at Giza may have served as the location for the ceremony. All this finds a strange, distorted twin in Mexico. We have seen the prevalence of human sacrifice there in pre-conquest times. Is it coincidental that the sacrificial venue was a pyramid, that the ceremony was conducted by a high priest and 4 assistants, that a cutting instrument, the sacrificial knife, was used to strike a hard physical blow to the body of the victim, and that the victim's soul was believed to ascend directly to the heavens, sidestepping the perils of the underworld? As such coincidences continue to multiply, it is reasonable to wonder whether there may not be some underlying connection. This is certainly the case when we learn that the general term for sacrifice throughout ancient Central America was pachi, meaning to open the mouth. Could it be, therefore, that what confronts us here, in widely separated geographical areas and at different periods of history, is not just a series of startling coincidences, but some faint and garbled common memory originating in the most distant antiquity? It doesn't seem that the Egyptian ceremony of the opening of the mouth influenced directly the Mexican ceremony of the same name, or vice versa for that matter. The fundamental differences between the two cases rule that out. What does seem possible, however, is that their similarities may be the remnants of a shared legacy received from a common ancestor. The peoples of Central America did one thing with that legacy, and the Egyptians another, but some common symbolism and nomenclature was retained by both. This is not the place to expand on the sense of an ancient and elusive connectedness that emerges from the Egyptian and Central American evidence. Before moving on, however, it is worth noting that a similar connectedness links the belief systems of pre-Columbian Mexico with those of Sumer in Mesopotamia. Again, the evidence is more suggestive of an ancient common ancestor than of any direct influence. Take the case of Oannes, for example. Oannes is the Greek rendering of the Sumerian Uan, the name of the amphibious being described in Part 2 believed to have brought the arts and skills of civilization to Mesopotamia. Legends dating back at least 5,000 years relate that Uan lived under the sea, emerging from the waters of the Persian Gulf every morning to civilize and tutor mankind. Is it a coincidence that Uana, in the Mayan language, means he who has his residence in water? Let us also consider Tiamat, the Sumerian goddess of the oceans and of the forces of primitive chaos, always shown as a ravening monster. In Mesopotamian tradition, Tiamat turned against the other deities and unleashed a holocaust of destruction before she was eventually destroyed by the celestial hero Marduk. She opened her mouth, Tiamat, to swallow him. He drove in the evil wind so that she could not close her lips. The terrible winds filled her belly. Her heart was seized. She held her mouth wide open. He let fly an arrow. It pierced her belly. Her inner parts he clove. He split her heart. He rendered her powerless and destroyed her life. He felled her body and stood upright on it. How do you follow an act like that? Marduk could. Contemplating his adversary's monstrous corpse, he conceived works of art, and a great plan of world creation began to take shape in his mind. His first move was to split Tiamat's skull and cut her arteries. Then he broke her into two parts like a dried fish, using one half to roof the heavens and the other to surface the earth. From her breasts he made mountains, from her spittle clouds, and he directed the rivers Tigris and Euphrates to flow from her eyes. A strange and violent legend, and a very old one. The ancient civilizations of Central America had their own version of this story. Here Quetzalcoatl, in his incarnation as the creator deity, took the role of Marduk, while the part of Tiamat was played by Cipactli, the great earth monster. Quetzalcoatl seized Cipactli's limbs as she swam in the primeval waters and wrenched her body in half, one part forming the sky and the other the earth. From her hair and skin he created grass, flowers, and herbs, from her eyes wells and springs, from her shoulders mountains. Are the peculiar parallels between the Sumerian and Mexican myths pure coincidence? Or could both have been marked by the cultural fingerprints of a lost civilization? If so, the faces of the heroes of that ancestral culture may indeed have been carved in stone and passed down as heirlooms through thousands of years, sometimes in full view, sometimes buried, until they were dug up for the last time by archaeologists in our era and given labels like Olmec Head and Uncle Sam. The faces of those heroes also appear at Monte Albán, where they seem to tell a sad story. Monte Albán, the downfall of masterful men. A site thought to be about 3,000 years old, Monte Albán stands on a vast, artificially flattened hilltop overlooking Oaxaca. It consists of a huge rectangular area, the Grand Plaza, which is enclosed by groups of pyramids and other buildings laid out in precise geometrical relationships to one another. The overall feel of the place is one of harmony and proportion, emerging from a well-ordered and symmetrical plan. Following the advice of SICOM, whom I had spoken to before leaving Villahermosa, I made my way first to the extreme southwest corner of the Monte Albán site. There, stacked loosely against the side of a low pyramid, were the objects I had come all this way to see, several dozen engraved stelae depicting Negroes and Caucasians, equal in life, equal in death. If a great civilization had indeed been lost to history, and if these sculptures told part of its story, the message conveyed was one of racial equality. No one who has seen the pride or felt the charisma of the great Negro heads from La Venta could seriously imagine that the original subjects of these magisterial sculptures could have been slaves. Neither did the lean-faced bearded men look as if they would have bent their knees to anyone. They too had an aristocratic demeanor. At Monte Albán, however, there seemed to be carved in stone a record of the downfall of these masterful men. It did not look as if this could have been the work of the same people who made the La Venta sculptures. The standard of craftsmanship was far too low for that, But what was certain, whoever they were, and however inferior their work, was that these artists had attempted to portray the same Negroid subjects and the same goatee-bearded Caucasians as I had seen at La Venta. There the sculptures had reflected strength, power, and vitality. Here at Monte Alban, the remarkable strangers were corpses. All were naked, most were castrated, some were curled up in fetal positions as though to avoid showers of blows, others lay sprawled slackly. Archaeologists said the sculptures showed the corpses of prisoners captured in battle. What prisoners? From where? The location, after all, was Central America, the New World, thousands of years before Columbus, so wasn't it odd that these images of battlefield casualties showed not a single Native American, but only and exclusively Old World racial types? For some reason, Orthodox academics did not find this puzzling, even though, by their reckoning, the carvings were extremely old, dating to somewhere between 1000 and 600 BC. As at other sites, this time frame had been derived from tests on associated organic matter, not on the carvings themselves, which were incised on granite stelae, and therefore hard to date objectively. Legacy. An as yet undeciphered, but fully elaborated hieroglyphic script had been found at Monte Alban, much of it carved on the same stelae as the crude Caucasian and Negro figures. Experts accepted that it was the earliest known writing in Mexico. It was also clear that the people who had lived here had been accomplished builders and more than usually preoccupied with astronomy. An observatory, consisting of a strange arrowhead-shaped structure, lay at an angle of 45 degrees to the main axis, which was deliberately tilted several degrees from north-south. Crawling into this observatory, I found it to be a warren of tiny, narrow tunnels and steep internal stairways, giving sight lines to different regions of the sky. The people of Monte Alban, like the people of Tres Zapotes, left definite evidence of their knowledge of mathematics in the form of bar and dot computations. They had also used the remarkable calendar, introduced by the Olmecs and much associated with the later Maya, which predicted the end of the world in the epoch of AD 2012. If the calendar and the preoccupation with time had been part of the legacy of an ancient and forgotten civilization, the Maya must be ranked as the most faithful and inspired inheritors of that legacy. Time, as the archaeologist Eric Thompson put it in 1950, was the supreme mystery of Maya religion, a subject which pervaded Maya thought to an extent without parallel in the history of mankind. As I continued my journey through Central America, I felt myself drawn ever more deeply into the labyrinths of that strange and awesome riddle.